Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to New Books and Film, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dan Moran. Daniel Devesay has worked at the Washington Post and USA Today. In 2001, he shared a Pulitzer with his colleagues at the Miami Herald for breaking news reporting. The author of four previous books, he is here today to talk about his latest, The Blues Brothers, An Epic Friendship, The Rise of Improv, and The Making of an American Film Classic, just published in 2024 by the Atlantic Monthly Press. Welcome, Daniel.
It's a pleasure, sir.
So I have to tell you and our listeners at the start that this is a terrific book. I say this not to ingratiate myself with you, but it's the God's honest truth. It's funny. It's actually touching at moments. It's a great, great glimpse into the messy, messy business of making movies. So first question, why the Blues Brothers?
It's a good question. The timing of it is bizarre because this isn't some big anniversary or anything. But the reason is this. I was doing a biography of the great B.B. King, and you got to go back 4 years ago. I was finishing it, basically, and I had occasion to call John Landis, the great director, because I wanted to know why B.B. King wasn't in the Blues Brothers, because he's the king of the blues. Shouldn't he have been in the Blues Brothers? So I found John Landis's home phone number, poor guy, and I called him and got him on the phone, and we talked, and then we talked a couple more times over the next few weeks, and we just got to talking about The Blues Brothers, which I love that movie. I told him that I had it, you know, kind of on constant rotation in Chicago when I was growing up. I had a bootleg of it, you know, and I would show it to all my friends, and it was one of my faves. And he said, well, you know, and this is John Landis imitation, well, you know what the real mission from God was, you know. And like then he got me hooked. What I mean, there was a secret mission from God. And when he told me that, I was hooked and I wanted to write a book about it, basically.
So let's talk about the structure of the book because B.B. King's absence comes up later in it. But before we get into like the nitty gritty of the movie, there's about 200 pages in your book before, you know, frame one is shot of the Blues Brothers. And that's not a knock at all. It's like really, really a cohesive look. So can you talk about your decision of how to structure it? Because, you know, other writers might have started a lot closer to the start date of the Blues Brothers. But you go into like John Belushi's background and his life story and Dan Aykroyd's. Yeah. You do Second City and SNL and The Lampoon. So talk about that decision and how you made that choice.
You know, I wrote this book by a formula. And the formula is the same formula I used to write Andy and Don, which was my first solo book, which is almost 10 years ago now. That was a dual biography of Andy Griffith and Don Knotts. Don was my brother-in-law. And that book, the way I did it was I had, you know, Don Knotts was born, then Andy Griffith was born, and I told their stories separately in the South and worked my way all the way up to where they got to be somewhat well-known and met each other and became besties. And then I told their story together. And then, yeah, about halfway through the book, they create the Andy Griffith Show together. And that's the big payoff of the book. That's the big, big centerpiece of it. And then after the Andy Griffith Show is over, I take the readers through the rest of their lives until they both die. And I just felt like that worked. That book is my greatest hit. It sold a lot of copies. A lot of people seem to have been, you know, made very happy by it. So I figured I'd just do the same formula. So in this case, Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi also were great, great friends. It was kind of a historic sort of Hollywood friendship. And I thought, well, this is a dual biography. It's also a book about the film. And it's also a book about, you know, their times. I mean, they came up in this really remarkable, remarkable group of improv guys and comedy guys, Steve Martin and the Schitt's Creek guys and John Candy and Bill Murray and Harold Ramis were all in this cohort. They all knew each other. They were all in Second City. They were both, most of them were in Lampoon, and they were a bunch of them were in Saturday Night Live. And this seemed like a great chance to do like three things at once, basically a dual biography, the story of this improv generation that is so amazing, and then the story of this fabulous film that was kind of the high point of this friendship and the high point, I would say, of each guy's career, in my opinion.
Yeah, and that works so well because we take things like SNL for granted, yeah. But you really let the reader see how new that was. Like when Samurai Delicatessen comes on for the first time, we've seen that a billion times. And what was that like to be, you know, in middle America watching that at 11:30 on a Saturday night and having no idea what was going to happen?
It was entropy. I mean, it would have been like how my pop felt the first time he he fell asleep and woke up and Monty Python was on, and he'd never seen it before. Nobody had seen it before in Chicago, and he thought he was dreaming. And so I think with SNL, there was a similar reaction when it first aired.
And as you just said, this it was unbelievable that there was this like crock pot of talent just all simmering, and they're all roughly the same age. You know, Gilda Radner also, and Chevy Chase, and they're all in there at the same time. And they all, with a couple plus or minuses, seemed to enjoy each other's company. They all thought each other were funny. So you do a great job of bringing that background to the reader long before the Blues Brothers is even an idea.
There was sweetness in those friendships, and there was rivalry too. Belushi and Chevy Chase were rivals and said some words to each other, but I think it spurred each of them to do greater things.
Yeah, and the friendship you just said was also interesting because Aykroyd and Belushi throughout the book, and I guess throughout their lives, they really do maintain this solid friendship. Like there's some darkness in the book about what happens, but there's no like VH1 Behind the Music scene where like Aykroyd and Belushi get into a big fight and say it used to be about the music. Like they really were friends.
I think they were almost like soulmates in terms of guy friendships from kind of the beginning. And I've tried to figure this out in my brain. I think they were kind of like opposites attract because they're very different. I mean, not just the physical types, you're sort of, you know, stocky, shorter guy and slender, tall guy. But okay, Aykroyd was really, really cerebral and like kind of methody and wrote everything out and scripted everything and had a backstory for every one of his 1,000 characters. Belushi was Mr. Effett, didn't carry ID, would like cross over into Canada without a driver's license and just, but he was this bulldozer of momentum once he had an idea. And he's really the one who propelled this Blues Brothers idea forward once Aykroyd had carefully scripted it. So opposites attract, but then there's way more in common than different about them. I mean, gosh, each was on Second City, one in Chicago, the other in Toronto. Each had been a kind of frustrated musician as a kid. Each was hilariously funny. Each one of them would do like serious drama when they were in high school and make stuff up and like enrage their professor. And so they had a ton more in common than they had different. And I think they were just smitten with each other, both for what they shared in common and for the differences between them.
You tell that story of when Dan Aykroyd was in school, he was in high school, and he went to the variety show, and his act was something like a day in the life of our school. And he just did imitations of all the teachers and got in a lot of trouble. And that's something you can imagine him doing, right?
Yeah, the priests. They let him have it.
So let's talk about their backstory. So let's do the dual biography a bit to fill our readers in. So what's something you learned, or what was your big takeaway when you did the research into Dan Aykroyd's, you know, growing up and coming on the scene?
I didn't really know that much about him. He's kind of on the spectrum. I mean, I think he's kind of genius-y, and he's also a little bit on that spectrum in terms of like maybe Asperger's. I think he had Tourette's syndrome when he was a kid, but very, very intelligent. Came up in this family that was, you know, ancient British family that had moved to Canada. And so his dad's like the civil servant, but pretty highly placed. I think she filmed the princess who was to be the queen, you know, when she came to Canada. And they lived in this kind of stately sort of Victorian house in Ottawa, the capital of Canada. So all this was fascinating to me. And most people who read the book, anybody listening to this will know more about Belushi than Aykroyd. And Aykroyd's fascinating. The fundamental thing you need to know about Aykroyd is he had this duality to him where he's very erudite, but he's also a rebel. So he invites you into his house and offers you a joint. Here, have a puff, you know. Very erudite, but also kind of a rebel. So he has friends who are like off-duty cops and kind of shady characters, and is kind of involved a little bit in the underworld of Canada, if there is such a thing. But he's also very highborn and very polite and well-bred. So the ultimate joke about him, which Rosie Schuster told me, that was Lorne Michaels' wife at the time, was that his ultimate fantasy, Aykroyd's, would be to commit a crime and then arrest himself. That's Aykroyd.
How about John Belushi's early days? What's something you learned about that or that you would want your readers to remember?
Oh, anybody will be fascinated by this if they don't know the story, and not many people do. He was a jock. I mean, he was this guy who was into football and didn't drink at all. He fit in a way perfectly in Wheaton, which was a dry town way out west of Chicago where I'm from. And so he was this big, big burly guy on the football team, although he only made it to about 5'8 or something. So I don't see, he wouldn't have played pro ball. But so that was him all through high school. He even tries to get his quarterback in trouble for drinking beer, which is kind of hilarious in hindsight. And then he goes off onto summer stock theater in Indiana the summer after high school and discover, well, to his ultimate woe, he discovers both beer and weed and turns into a hippie and stops being a jock. And I think his sort of lifelong habit of substance abuse begins that summer of 1967. And he comes back and he's in the army gear and he's got the long hair and he goes to the 68 protest and gets like tear gassed. And that was his transformation. I didn't know any of that because by the time I knew Belushi on SNL, which I think I watched a few of the episodes when I was like 11 or something, he wasn't either of those things. He wasn't really a hippie. He wasn't really, certainly wasn't a jock. He was, you know, this kind of famous performer, but he'd gone through a lot of changes by the time he entered the Second City cast for the first time right around 1970. He was at the time their kind of resident hippie. In fact, he replaced Harold Ramis, who had been their resident hippie. Harold Ramis had this big like Jufro, went on a sabbatical, and Belushi replaced him.
You tell a story early in the book during the Belushi biography about how he had this habit of falling asleep with lit cigarettes. And it's impossible now in hindsight not to see that as kind of like a metaphor, a symbolic moment of his life.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure on some level he was conscious of the risk he was taking falling asleep with a cigarette. And so it's self-destructive. I think he was kind of hurtling toward his final exit in a tragic way. The villain in my book, right? Each of my books has had a villain, but they're not necessarily like a dude. In the B.B. King bio, the villain is racism, right? And in this book, the villain is addiction. The villain is addiction. It's the villain in Bob Woodward's Wired book as well. And it's the villain in mine. And the villain wins in the end, but boy, do we have a lot of fun while Belushi's still breathing.
Yeah. Now, when it's funny you mentioned that, because when Wired, I remember when that came out in 84, that was a big controversy. Was, you know, it seemed like a lot of the Hollywood establishment were scolding Woodward for his portrayal of Belushi, or like for telling tales out of school or things like that. And, you know, he got a lot of condemnation for it, for putting that book out from the people involved. Like, do you have a take on that? Like, how was your portrayal of Belushi maybe different, or what did you try to do as a writer?
God, really different. I spoke to Woodward. You have to know about Woodward that when he set out to do Wired, I believe he was initially going to do a series of articles for the Washington Post. And Woodward was an investigative reporter, and he wanted to investigate the manner of Belushi's death. And that is what he did. And that's what the book is. It's an investigation of his death, basically. And so naturally, the focus of the book is on his addiction and sort of, you know, documenting almost every puff that he took, every snoot. It's very clinical. It's not very fun. It's not very funny. But that was the project that I would say Woodward was assigned to do. So that's one thing you need to know. And the other thing is, so very much has changed in how Belushi is regarded in popular culture, how SNL is regarded in popular culture, and all of these characters. In 1980, whatever, four, when Wired came out, Belushi had died. He had not made the front page of the New York Times. His obituary was buried inside. He was regarded as the SNL funny man who was kind of this crazy guy. He was not regarded, I don't think, as a comedy legend. I don't think anybody from that SNL cast, not Bill Murray, not Harold Ramis, not Gilda Radner, I don't think any of them were considered to be these huge legends. I don't think SNL itself was considered a legendary show. It was pretty much all but off the air. It was on life support at that point. So to give Woodward a break, he wasn't writing about these iconic legends of entertainment. He was writing about it, a very popular actor who died young. And so not just my book, but any number of books and articles that have talked about Belushi in the last 10, 20 years have regarded him in a very different light. He's now considered to be this massive icon of comedy. You know, I think Rolling Stone said he was the greatest of all SNL performers. If you put anybody over him now, maybe Eddie Murphy, just because of how far above everyone else he was and how he kind of single-handedly saved the show in the 80s. But Belushi was arguably one of the one or two or three greatest people in this absolutely legendary television show. But Woodward didn't have that perspective in 1983 or whatever, right?
Right. Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, yeah. That how his reputation changed over time.
Oh, yeah.
So let's move on to the Blues Brothers. So I love the opening of the book. You talk about a 1978 episode of SNL where the Blues Brothers first appeared, and you capture perfectly what I think was many people's reactions, which is like, Here's your quote. Why were Saturday Night Live's breakout comedians masquerading as urban bluesmen? If their act was a joke, how far would it go? And I distinctly remember like watching that and waiting for the gags. Like, are they going to do a skit? Are they going to like, and it was the song and the song was over. So talk about their first moment on SNL and people's reactions.
It was a puzzler. You have to go back, and this is hard to picture now, but these were two television comedians with no discernible musical talent who suddenly in 1978 decide to reinvent themselves as frontmen to this top flight rhythm and blues combo. And then they proceed to tour the country and to play all these gigs at places like Poplar Creek and Universal Amphitheater as a serious musical act. I would argue this is pretty much unprecedented. Can you think of an example of untrained musical guys or women from television who just decide all of a sudden to go out on tour with a band and that's their thing and it's serious? Nobody knew what to make of them. I mean, nobody had any idea what was happening until they hit Universal Amphitheater that September 1978 and sell it out, you know, nine nights in a row opening for Steve Martin. And then everybody realized, wow, this isn't a joke, A, and B, it's effing entertaining. And so question yeah. answered, you know.
With a band that good.
With an amazing band. And Chris Borelli, the great Tribune reporter in Chicago, asked me, well, what about Belushi? Wasn't he kind of a weak link? He's not a great singer. And you could argue this point. He's an adequate singer. I mean, he's a good enough singer. But the thing about Belushi is if you watch footage of them or if you were at one of these shows, he got great reviews. He got great reviews. And the reason is he's just this phenomenal performer, right? He's not a phenomenal singer. He's not Joe Cocker, but he does a great Joe Cocker imitation. And he's a terrific frontman, a terrific entertainer. And he would just captivate the audience. He was this, you know, gravitational field unto himself and would just hold the audience in thrall. And there's lots of great singers who can't do that. And Belushi could.
Yeah, you can imagine all the people that bought the Blues Brothers album when it came out and waited for the comedy tracks on it. It was another comedy album by two guys. And it's all the songs. It's Hey Bartender and all these other great songs. Yeah. So Belushi does Animal House. It's an unbelievably big hit. John Landis directs it, obviously, right? And then Aykroyd writes the script for the Blues Brothers. So talk about that initial script and what it was like, because this is fascinating in the book.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, just the sheer weirdness that there was going to be a movie about the Blues Brothers.
Right.
There had not been a film about an SNL sketch. I mean, these are sketches. They're 3 minutes long.
Right.
And this was a weird one. And it seemed like a one-off. So why is there going to be this two-hour movie about them? And what's it going to be? And that, again, was a puzzler for film fans of that era, for television fans, for Belushi fans. But you need to understand that coming off of Animal House, Belushi had the number one comedy film, and he was the unrivaled star of it. So there was going to be another Belushi film. I mean, he was a huge box office draw at that point, as big as it gets. And the only question was what the film was going to be. And in the summer and fall of 1978, all that he was interested in was the Blues Brothers. So Universal, his minders, decide, well, okay, we'll make a go write a Blues Brothers film. And that's what Aykroyd did. And yeah, I haven't seen the entire script. I think the producers, like, you know, fax machine broke down after sending the first 100 pages of it, but it was 320 some pages long, that's 320 some minutes worth of film, which is too much, obviously, for one film or even two. And it's fascinating as a read because it's like a really elongated version of the script you ultimately get. A lot of the real final lines and scenes are in there. Aykroyd was brilliant. He's a very, very intelligent guy. He was really brilliant at sort of envisioning this very, very long series of sketches. But he goes into these endless long backstories on each musician. And yeah, it would have been very hard on the posterior to sit through that film as Aykroyd initially scripted it. And because he's funny, he delivered it onto the lawns of all these, you know, Beverly Hills guys, wrapped in the cover of an actual phone book, just to put a punchline on the joke that this was a really long script.
It's great because you point out that now we take the idea that an SNL skit can become a movie for granted. So Wayne's World is a hit on SNL. Let's make a movie. We'll make a movie of the Coneheads. We'll do all these other things. But how strange it was that of all those skits let's do the Blues Brothers where they haven't talked on stage. Well, you know, we know they have this act, but we're going to build an entire universe around these two guys, Jake and Elwood.
Yeah. And everybody would have had every right to think the film was going to suck.
Right.
I mean, it's a one joke And, you know,
Right.
how on earth could this film ever be good? And again, in hindsight, it's fascinating to compare that film with the other films adapted, Saturday Night Live sketches. They're all over the map. I would argue this is probably the best of those. And then there's all these other, a bigger universe of films that are sort of SNL DNA. I just watched Tommy Boy the other night with Chris Farley, who was sort of a latter-day Belushi acolyte, and David Spade. And, you know, there's some good films with SNL DNA in them. But I would argue Blues Brothers is in a category of its own for reasons we can talk about later.
Sure. Well, let's talk about the shooting of the film, right? So this film, like I said before, the mess of it is so wonderfully detailed in your book. And one thing that was totally new to me was how much Jane Byrne was involved in making this thing happen. So please tell our listeners, who is Jane Byrne, and bring her into the story.
Oh, Jane Byrne. Okay. Well, I was a kid in a Chicago ruled by Richard Daley, the elder, Richard J. Daley. He was the mayor for life, pretty much, until I think he died of a heart attack. And he never uttered a grammatically correct sentence. He was Irish from the Southwest Side, and he ruled Chicago. And sometime around 1955, some production came in there with a narrative that had to do with corrupt police, I think, in Chicago, and Daley didn't like it. And he put a stop to filming in Chicago. Now, it wasn't entirely stopped. Borelli in the Tribune points out there was apparently a thriving porn industry near North, and a few films got made there. I think My Bodyguard was one I watched while I was in probably middle school, and Cooley High School, I think, was made in Chicago.
Cooley
but there
High,
weren't
yep.
many. There weren't many. There was a paucity of films made in Chicago. Mayor Byrne got this idea of a Blues Brothers film on her desk. She was the, I think, the second mayor elected after Daley. Bolandic, I think, came first. Mayor Byrne was the first female mayor in Chicago. She was teased and ridiculed and mocked by a lot of Daley's cronies. They were very sexist and called her names and stuff that would not ever pass now. And this was some sweet revenge for her. Here came this film crew that wanted to march into Chicago and drive like a military convoy across Richard J. Daley Plaza. So she
A
thought
tank.
that was just a fine idea. And that's how I would say the film was green lit. And so she opened Chicago back up. And this is how you get all these John Hughes films, your Ferris Bueller's, you know, and all these great films, the Fugitive, you know, in the years to come. So God bless Jane Byrne for doing that, because I love all these Chicago films, and there weren't very many when I was young.
Well, it's so great that of all, it's not like some small interior chamber drama that wanted to use exteriors of the Chicago skyline. It's like no, we're going to welcome everyone back with the Blues Brothers. We're going to close off major highways. We're going to have stuntmen going right up to the end of a drawbridge and do it again and do it again and do it again.
They shut down the city or parts of it at times in a way that would not have been imaginable even then, probably in LA or New York, this according to the crew, and would not probably be imaginable in Chicago now. I mean, Lakeshore Drive is extremely important, and they just shut it down. And they shut down Lower Wacker Drive, which is this really important service corridor, and they would shut down Lake Street, which is, you know, a vital part of the loop. They shut down Daley Plaza, albeit during a holiday weekend. But Chicago has a small town feel to it, or it did when I was growing up there, and everybody in town knew this was happening, and people were excited about it.
And you quote all the memos of telling the crew, do not hit the Picasso. You do not mess up the Picasso when you're shooting the scene.
Oh, yeah. No, although I think some of us would have been perfectly happy to see that thing go down in flames. It's a weird piece of sculpture.
So I want to get your reaction to a quote you offer in the book. This is from Sean Daniel at Universal. And here's what he says, quote, "You didn't want to be the Universal Studios executive in charge of this production. And that executive was me."
There was a generational divide at Universal inside the Black Tower at this huge film studio. There was a lot of older executives, and then there were some younger ones. Sean Daniel and Tom Mount were in their 20s, and they were allowed to take charge of Animal House. And this Animal House was a film the older guys did not get. Older people generally didn't get National Lampoon humor. I would argue they didn't really get Second City humor in the 70s, because it was a younger, hipper humor. And so older film critics didn't really understand Animal House. Janet Maslin at the time, she did. She loved Animal House, but she was young. She was in her 20s. She told me she'd worked at Lampoon briefly. So she got it. Roger Ebert, the young Sun-Times critic got it. Tom Shales, the young television writer at the Washington Post, he got it. The older guys didn't. So Sean Daniel was a 20-something executive who was given this wreck of a film and told, you know, you'd better not, you know, break anything or spend too much. And of course, they did both of those things.
Yeah. So what's one of the wildest stories you learned about the making of the film? I mean, there's so many because if you love this film, and people that love this movie have seen it like 30 times, like no one, it's like potato chips. Nobody watches the Blues Brothers once and says, oh, one day I'll reach. It's just a movie you said like before you had it on, you have it on a loop. And it's so fun to read about the mall scene and to read about the Illinois Nazis and exactly how that was done. So what were some of the stories or one of the fun ones that surprised you that you learned?
Well, there was a couple of them involved film canisters. There was a film canister filled with cocaine that arrived at one point. And one of my sources, I shan't say whom, told me this. And then I won't say whom, but a couple of the higher up people who were my sources said, oh, that can't be. It cannot be. You know, that must be wrong. That's just ridiculous nonsense. So I went back and found a second source that said, oh, yeah, some of that cocaine was for me. So that's in the book. And this is the quantity of cocaine. And supposedly that canister was just for Belushi. And that's a lot of cocaine to fit in a film canister. And there's another film canister moment that's hilarious, which is there was a speakeasy in Chicago, you know, in the sort of old town neighborhood that Belushi and Aykroyd set up so they could blow off steam late at night. And it was one of these where you kind of had to know somebody to get in. And one night they're all partying there. And this time they're passing around a film canister filled with weed. And it reaches the hands of Jackson Browne, who was in town, the great musical guy. And then he passes it to the next guy on the table. And that next guy is the warden of Joliet Prison. And so here's the warden of Joliet Prison holding a film canister filled with weed. But it wasn't his house. It wasn't his rules. So he just sort of politely passed it on to the next person. So I just like those two film canister stories.
Yeah, you tell the stories of how Belushi and Aykroyd had their secret club. I love that. Like they would find a place, they would rent it, get a jukebox. That was the first thing they did was get a jukebox.
Always,
and they would go there
a jukebox
all night, and then they'd make the movie the next day.
And Keith Richard did 10 bars at least in New York. Yeah, there were speakeasies in Ottawa. There was one in New York, and there was one in Chicago.
Yeah, wild. And that they did this and then they went and filmed the Blues Brothers next day. And you also quote one executive, I forget who, says, well, how are you going to have a movie where everybody has sunglasses on the whole time? And somebody says, have you seen these guys' eyes? Like, they got to leave the sunglasses on.
No, you're exactly right. Some of the shots, Stephen Katz, the brilliant cinematographer, didn't do close-ups of the band. And somebody says, well, where's the close-ups? You say, close-ups? Have you seen their eyes? You know, they were dropping... literally had dropped acid. A lot of the band had dropped acid the day that they filmed that the scene with the, you know, it's never too late to mend inside the jail. They were on acid. So no, there were no close-ups that day. And the glasses, the dark sunglasses on Jake and Elwood were providential because they were bleary-eyed more often than not, both of them.
You tell the story that when they did the mall scene, the famous chase in the mall, of how they found this abandoned mall and it was going to be and you get the sense that they kept just kind of like lying to their uppers and say, no, it'll be fine. We get it for this much. Now we get it for this much. And then they had to paper over all the windows to make it look like it was dark. And they had to get all the stuntmen and how many close calls there were when they actually filmed that scene.
Yeah. A couple things about that scene that are fascinating that obviously I didn't know. One is that there's a stunt woman, you know, the Miss Piggy moment.
Yeah, do you
have a Miss Piggy? And the car comes barreling through. There's an athletic young black woman who leaps out of the way. And according to the assistant director, she almost got clipped. I mean, you can tell watching it. Watch it and with that in mind, and it will scare you. Okay, that's one thing. Another thing is because it was supposed to be a nighttime sequence inside this mall, they covered and sealed every single window and door. And then there's these exhaust fumes. I suppose it was probably leaded gasoline and all these cars and burning rubber, and it must have been just a foul, foul environment. Along with, there was all this real merchandise. They used real merchandise, and the deal was they would return what didn't get wrecked, and a lot of it did. But I'm talking about like produce in the Jewel food store, which was rotting day after day after day. So they would apparently file outside every so often and just fill their lungs with clean air because the space where they were filming was so unspeakably foul. And it's a little hard to imagine that happening in a film shoot now, but, you know, standards were different in 1979 than they are today.
Yeah, and I think the total bill for that scene was something like, I think it, if I have this right, it's like $89,000, I think, for that sequence, right? And but it reminds you of how the reason that movie, one of the reasons that movie's so fun is that there's no CGI. Like you're really watching them do those stunts in a way that you can appreciate it, where today it would be all digitized.
That's right. You know it's real. And now when I watch films from before, whenever before Beauty and the Beast, you know, whenever they started doing CGI, I marvel at wow, that's an actual, that's not a drone, that's a helicopter. And
Right.
Landis had a helicopter at one point over the steelworks to get that opening scene, the sort of, you know, panorama scene. And apparently they were shooting at them. The guards actually opened fire on the helicopter. So it was tricky getting those shots back in the day.
So we love Aykroyd and Belushi. We love the car chases, but we also love the music, and that's a big part of your book too. So let's talk about the music for a little bit, and let's go through some of the performers in the movie and how they ended up in the movie and kind of what the movie did for them and what they did for the film. So let's start with the Godfather, James Brown.
Well, the irony is he wasn't originally going to be in the film.
Right.
That preacher role, the natural person for it at that time would have been Little Richard because he was an actual real preacher. I guess they could have gotten Al Green. And so Landis went to meet with Little Richard, Richard Penniman, but he was too spiritual at that point in his life. He didn't want to leave his flock and do this sort of probably, what's the term for something that's not godly film. And so he turned them down. So ironically enough, James Brown, possibly the greater figure or certainly equal to Little Richard and his only rival for sheer power, was available and more than ready to do the scene. And most of these artists had fallen on kind of hard times. And that's the secret mission from God. The reason Aykroyd made this movie, I swear to you, this is the reason, was he wanted to rejuvenate the careers of his heroes, many of whom had hit the shoals of disco and arena rock. You know, no offense to any of these people, but the Bee Gees, Donna Summer, Cheap Trick, you know, AC/DC, Van Halen ruled the charts and the amphitheaters. And Aretha, James Brown, certainly Cab Calloway, you know, were not charting very high and were not playing very enviable halls at that point in their career. So that's James Brown. He was delighted to do it.
Yeah, you make a point somewhere in the book that you could not turn on the radio at this time for 10 minutes and not hear the Bee Gees.
You know, it was a. I remember this time. I was anti-disco. My sister-in-law has a theory. This is Don Knotts's widow has a theory, which is that boys were scared of dancing, so boys, and I was a boy, hated disco because they were afraid of having to dance. And that's why they wanted to hear their Cheap Trick and their AC/DC. And I think she's probably right.
That's really interesting, because that's yeah, it makes a lot of sense if you think back to middle school
Yeah, you were afraid to dance, right? I was afraid
yeah,
to dance.
and it was cool to hate disco. It was cool to show that
Yeah.
you were like it was beneath you.
Yeah. And I think guys were the ones who populated Comiskey Park the night of the great disco demolition. It was all guys. And I
Right.
think they were just afraid of having to dance with their girlfriends, so they wanted to destroy every disco record.
And John Travolta make it look easy, so that's you know that
He
was
did. Damn him. Yeah.
So we did James Brown. Let's talk about Aretha Franklin.
Aretha Franklin, I think, was a first choice to play her part, which was a diner owner and the wife of Matt Guitar Murphy, the great blues guitarist who was enlisted to beef up the actual blues credentials of this rhythm and blues outfit. Remember, a lot of the guys in this combo, the Blues Brothers band, they're the Stax rhythm and blues rhythm section, you know, Duck Dunn and Steve Cropper, and then the SNL horns. It's a rhythm and blues outfit, but you know, Matt Guitar Murphy was a hard blues guitarist, so he added some blues heft. Aretha plays his wife, his long-suffering wife, and the diner owner who gives him a piece of her mind. And they already had in mind they were going to have her do the song "Think," which fit perfectly into the script. So Aretha was up for doing it. She was leery, though. I quote her brother saying that she didn't want to play sort of a glorified waitress, you know, a servile sort of role. She was sensitive to that, and I completely understand that. Once she showed up on the set, though, and beheld this sort of beautiful top dollar reconstruction of the diner interior in Hollywood, I think she realized the money that was going into this and the scale of it, and she was impressed. But a couple of little bits of trivia that most people won't know. She didn't want to do Think, she wanted to do Respect. All of these guys wanted to do their biggest song because they really wanted to leverage this. to, you know, raise their currency. And then the other thing was, once she decided to do Think, and she did a beautiful version of it, that which is different from the one in the single, she couldn't remember the words, and for whatever psychological reason. And so the sound guy, Kaplan, wrote them on a whiteboard, and then she needed her glasses. This is like a Fawlty Towers sort of thing. I need my glasses. And so she had never glasses, and so she couldn't read the lyrics. So it was a bit of a disaster, but it turned out great. And a lot of the critics who otherwise hated the film loved that scene, the Aretha scene.
How about the Ray Charles scene?
Well, Ray Charles, again, was very up for doing it. I think he was doing a little better commercially than some of the others. And also, he was later in the arc of his career, so it probably didn't matter as much. But he was enlisted to play the guy who sells the gear to the band. He's a blind pawn shop owner, and there's kind of a gag where he sort of fires a gun at a kid who's trying to steal something. And apparently, you know, because he was blind, he misfired the gun a couple of times, and John Lennon said, "Take the gun away from Mr. Charles," you know. There's one funny thing that I certainly didn't know about this scene. If you watch it very closely, when Murph is negotiating, haggling over the purchase of this keyboard, if you look in the background, you can see the horns standing at this sort of glass counter, sort of goofing around. What they were actually doing was pretending to cut up some lines of coke. Now, I don't know how that's done. I promise you I've never done it. But they were doing that just because they thought it was funny. And then eventually they summoned the courage to cut up actual lines of real coke while Landis was filming. Well, I think Landis figured it out, and he yelled cut. So I don't think you see them cutting actual coke in the scene, although who knows. But that was the spirit of the times, and it was certainly the spirit of the shoot. And the horns reminded Landis, when he yelled at them, that, well, he had after all asked them to act like musicians, and that's what they were doing.
That was a big part. He gave them that direction. He said, you know, I remember the book, he tells them, don't act. Don't act. Just, and that's why they're so charming in the movie.
They're not trying to act. I love them. I love especially the drummer, whose name I'm not going to remember now. Willie Hall, I think is his name. He turns on Jake and Elwood, and he's menacing.
We give him one more chance. We give the Blues Brothers one more chance.
Murph from the Magic Jones. He had some actual acting experience. Most of them didn't. They're adorable and endearing, and these are real important performers, so they really gave some heft to the film, having Cropper and Dunn there and Matt Guitar Murphy. I mean, man, great cast.
Everybody loves Johnny Lee Hooker in this film singing Boom Boom, but you point out that scene, you know, everyone wishes that were longer. If there was one musical bit in the movie that everybody wishes went on a little longer, it's probably that scene where he's playing. Yeah. So talk about Johnny Lee Hooker.
Well, originally that scene was going to include not just John Lee Hooker, but also Muddy Waters. Waters had agreed to be in the film, so it was going to be both of them. And I would picture it that maybe it was going to segue from Boom Boom into one of Muddy's great hits. But at the last moment, Muddy was ill and couldn't show up, so the production couldn't wait, so they cut him. So it was a great showcase for John Lee Hooker. But so later on, after the film was done, it was too long in the eyes of the studio execs. It was almost 3 hours. And that was pretty long for a film in 1980. So Landis and George Folsey, the editor, had to cut it quickly and way down. And so about half of that Boom Boom song was removed. And I think that might be unique among the musical numbers. The rest of them, I think, are allowed to play all the way through. And Aykroyd told me directly that he was extremely upset about that. I'm sure Landis was too, losing part of that song. I think if you watch the restored footage in the extended cut of the film, I think you get the entire song. So that alone makes it worth seeking that out.
And last, but certainly not least, Cab Calloway and what this film did for him, because he did try to buy into the disco age. Right?
And let me just heap some praise on Landis and Aykroyd for getting just the greatest of the R&B legends. And I don't know, again, if you go back to 1979, how obvious it was that Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, James Brown were going to emerge in the end as sort of the titans of that era, of their era. But it was prescient of them, I think, to hire those people to be in this film. And Cab Calloway, I didn't really know this about him because I'm a little young, but in that era of sort of big band jazz era, he was, I think, maybe second only to Duke Ellington renown. And if Duke Ellington had still been alive, maybe he'd have been in the film too. But Cab Calloway was happy to do it. he had a bit of a meatier role playing Curtis, who was, I think, a janitor at the orphanage where the Blues Brothers were, the fictitious Blues Brothers were raised. And so he has a bit of a larger part. And Cab, like some of the others, wanted to raise his currency with his performance. So he asked if they could do, God help us all, a disco version of Minnie the Moocher, his great hit. And that had been, it had scraped the charts maybe a year earlier. And cooler heads prevailed, and they persuaded him to do the original song, which for which I'm very grateful. And he does a wonderful, wonderful performance in the film.
Yeah, it's beautiful. When he says hit it, all the costumes all change and he starts doing it. I mean, it's wonderful. Yeah. So you and I are sitting here gushing over this film and how much we love it and going through all the details, but not everybody loved the music and not everybody loved what Aykroyd and Belushi were kind of up to when this came out. So before we get into the reception of the film and stuff, what were some of the complaints people had, like these hardcore bluesologists say, about the film? Yeah.
Well, if you go back even to when the Blues Brothers were merely a band and were making a record and then releasing the record and playing at Universal Amphitheater, in Rolling Stone and in the alternative press especially, music writers really hammered them for cultural appropriation. That's not a new concept, the idea of white artists taking the work of Black artists and trying to make it their own. Was front and center in the Berkeley Barb and probably the Chicago Seed and in Rolling Stone. I quote a few really sharply worded critiques of the record, the first Blues Brothers record, and of the act. How dare these white famous comedians go out and try to pass themselves off as rhythm and blues singers singing historically Black music? So that was aired out at the time. And then it was aired out again when the movie came out. I quote at least one critic saying, this verges on racism, having a film that stars two white guys, singing blues, singing rhythm and blues, and then employs these great Black rhythm and blues icons in minor roles. Yes, all of that was hashed out at the time. And, you know, there's a response to that, which is, first of all, there was no way that a Blues Brothers film was going to be made that didn't star the Blues Brothers. Belushi in particular was the huge star. I mean, more so than Aykroyd or anyone else who was in the film. It was Belushi's thing. So there wouldn't have been a film had it not starred the Blues Brothers. And the other thing is, I think to the bottom of their souls, Aykroyd and Belushi really wanted nothing more than to showcase their heroes in this film. And that is what they did. I mean, when I went and saw the Blues Brothers for the first time, I think I saw it at the Parkway Theater in Chicago on Clark Street, probably for a buck. I'm not making this up. The next day or the next week, I went out and I did not buy the Blues Brothers album. I bought The Best of Sam and Dave, which is a prominent prop in the film. Yep. They're playing the cassette all the time. And so I went and bought it.
Yeah, no, so that's good. You also quote James Brown saying he was so happy that he was in the movie because he said all these young people who had never heard him or heard my music, all of a sudden they started listening to my stuff again, and he said it was great.
James Brown and Aretha, I believe, were on SNL back-to-back at the end of that year that the film came out. And if you look at setlists.com, you know, which chronicles where these guys played, they were playing at bigger venues. You can see it after the film came out than before. And most, if not all of them, to the actual performers, this was a gift being allowed to be in, Aretha got a star on the Walk of Fame. And I think this was her first movie role and just very nearly her only film role. So it was great for them all.
How was the movie reviewed? How did it do financially?
Well, that's two very different answers. The reviews were horrible. All of the main legacy publications, Time, Newsweek, New York Times, LA Times, Washington Post, dreadful reviews, everyone. Just about the only really good reviews came from Chicago. And that only probably because it was obviously such a great Chicago film. Also, Siskel and Ebert were younger reviewers. They were 20-something reviewers, maybe 30 years old, and they understood the comedy better maybe than some of the older reviewers in other cities did. But the reviews were awful. But the film did very, very well. It made about $1 million a day, which was considered a blockbuster pace at the time. And it kept making $1 million a day for, I think, more than 2 months. So it became one of the top films, maybe the second best. I think it was released in the same year as The Empire Strikes Back, and it didn't do better than that film. But I think it did better than just about every other film of the year. So commercially, it was a huge hit. Also, it was one of the first big films, Landis says maybe the first big film, to do better internationally than domestically. It made a little more money in Europe and overseas than it did in the States. And that is because of the fascination, the enduring fascination that people in Britain and Italy and France and Spain have for the great icons of Black American music. Thank goodness.
Yeah. It's fascinating to read those reviews, and they call the movie, you know, people calling it slow and turgid and self-indulgent. And to a fan like me, I'm like, no, the Blues Brothers, as soon as you put it on, it's over. It moves. It's perfect.
It does. It does.
So yeah. Let's get to the sadder things. You go through the rest of Belushi's career. You talk about, you know, continental divide and making Neighbors, and he starts to live more and more dangerously. You tell the stories of how he had his, like, he would have his minders and his trainers. March of 1982, he dies of an overdose. He's 33. So, yeah. You know, tell the story about his last days and kind of like how you've come to regard the life of this guy who was so beloved by so many people and what that story means.
Yeah. Right after the film was completed, Belushi went on one of his walkabouts, which was a term his minders used for when he would just disappear without a trace. And when he returned from that walkabout, I believe that was when his loved ones had the first real intervention with him about his drug use. So this is an important point. Cocaine was not regarded as a dangerous thing in 1979 or 1980. So the people around him didn't have this sense of foreboding that you'd have now about somebody using copious amounts of cocaine as well as heroin, I think, in the end, in Belushi's case. So one of the reviews, I think in maybe the Washington Post of my book, says, why didn't they halt filming? You know, because in my book, you know, one of the plot points is that Belushi nearly dies twice in the final week of shooting in Chicago. And it's a good question. Why didn't they halt filming? Well, again, I said this over and over, the production had to go on. The production had to go on. And again, I have to stress that the young people of that era just didn't have this terror about addictive drugs that they do now. So after the film gets made, finally they have kind of an intervention. Doesn't really work. For a while, Belushi is relatively clean. They have some wonderful moments, Belushi and Aykroyd on Martha's Vineyard with Judy, who was John's beloved wife. They have some really wonderful moments. If the movie ever gets made of this, you know, this is just this wonderful, you know, paradise moment before the fall. And then maybe inevitably Belushi slips back into addiction and it claims his life. Again, the villain in this book is addiction. Belushi was an addict. He succumbed to his addiction. What does it prove? I think he's one of many people, maybe including Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, a lot of Chris Farley, right? A lot of other people who couldn't handle extreme fame. And I think Belushi was vulnerable. I think he was kind of tormented in certain ways. But the most important thing is he was an addict and he self-medicated to handle the impossibility of being really, really, really famous. I've never been really famous. I have no idea what it's like. But, you know, I think you start dealing with a situation where you can't go out and do anything. You can't interact with the world without people surrounding you and coming at you. And other people I've written about, including Andy Griffith, dealt with the same problem. It's hard, I think. I mean, yeah, cry me a river, you're famous, man, you know, but it's hard, I guess, being really famous. And so I guess he's an object lesson that it's hard. If you're really famous, you have to figure out how to handle it.
Yeah, it reminded me a lot of Jerry Garcia.
Jerry Garcia. I don't know much about his life. I know he died young. I know he's a brilliant, brilliant guitarist, but I don't know what his life would have.
I thought of him about John Belushi, about me, was it, why did they stop the production? Was because we got to keep going. And that's what he, you know, Jerry was responsible for keeping this giant machine called the Grateful Dead going around. And all these people are depending on it. We got all these people on payroll.
Yeah.
We just keep going.
Same spirit. Definitely.
Same spirit. You also made me think about how when Belushi dies, you know, I did not know that until you said it, was that his obituary was not front page news the way it would be today, but how differently people thought about celebrities and drug culture and things. I remember being a little kid and my father telling me one day, hey, John Belushi died. And I said, what? How did he die? Was it a car accident? Was it some kind of mishap? And he said, no, he had a drug overdose. And I was so naive as a kid. I remember thinking like, John Belushi did drugs? Like, I couldn't believe it, right? Now we just take these things for granted about celebrities, but it seems like the machine used to do a better job of trying to contain that stuff.
Well, I think Belushi in the pages of Rolling Stone, which was the Belushi publication of record, I mean, he was hit, the drug culture around him was part of the fun in all the reporting about him up to the day he died. There'd be, you know, winking references to drug use everywhere. And I think also, in the alternative press and maybe even in the mainstream papers. In the mainstream press, they probably ignored it.
Sure.
But certainly in the alternative press and in Rolling Stone, drug culture is part of why people like Rolling Stone and like the rock music scene. And Belushi was like the Elvis, I think, of Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
I mean, he's such a massive figure in popular culture from that era. And one of the great quotes, which I think I put into my the epilogue, is I think George Carlin said, the way that cocaine makes you feel is like taking more cocaine.
Right. Yeah.
It's as simple as that. And they didn't get it in 1979 or 1982. And they finally figured it out maybe after Belushi died.
Yeah. So last question, the final pages of your book give us examples of how, you know, the Blues Brothers is as big as ever. I love this part where you ask Janet Maslin if she was too tough in her initial review. Like, that's a great thing. I was so proud of you for doing that. It's the same film that was released in 1980, but its reputation is different, right? So how do you account for its staying power?
In this epilogue, I go through four or five different reasons. It's to do, I think, with the ascent of Saturday Night Live over the years. SNL is considered an extremely important television show now, maybe one of the half dozen greatest works of the television medium, and it certainly was not that in 1980. And Belushi and Aykroyd were mainstays of the first and probably most glorious cast. Okay, that's one reason. Reason two, the alumni of this improv era from the 70s, Steve Martin, Bill Murray, Aykroyd, Belushi, Eddie Murphy, Chevy Chase, have done so much. Well, they've done bad things, but some of them, but they've done so much to burnish their legend over the decades. They're regarded as giants in entertainment now. And so that's a reason why The Blues Brothers now is considered an important film. Another thing is, to anybody from Chicago, I was talking to a highly placed bank executive today, and I asked him, what's your favorite Chicago film? So here's the thing. If you're from Chicago and you're wealthy or you're from the suburbs, then Ferris Bueller is probably your movie. If you're from the city, which I am, I was born on the South Side, or you're a little bit poor, maybe a reporter's salary, then it's The Blues Brothers. It's extremely important to anyone from Chicago, and there's a lot of us. I mean, the Cubs, think about how many fans the Cubs have. And then lastly, and most important, the film endures all these years later as an artifact of some of the greatest musical artists of our time. If you go on YouTube and type in James Brown or Aretha Franklin or John Lee Hooker, maybe the first thing that'll come up is a clip from the Blues Brothers. I mean, these are extremely important documents of who they were and why they mattered. And the film, for that reason alone, I think merits immortality. And I think that's probably why, you know, the Catholic Church has embraced it as one of a small number of films that it considers part of the canon, why the Library of Congress has embraced it. So I think that's probably, getting back to what I said 40 minutes ago, maybe why it's more important than the other films of the SNL DNA. Maybe it's even more important than, say, Groundhog Day, which is a brilliant film. And I think Groundhog Day might be the greatest film with sort of SNL DNA in it. But Blues Brothers, I think, matters more because of what it means in terms of the legacies of these great rhythm and blues icons.
The Blues Brothers, An Epic Friendship, The Rise of Improv, and The Making of an American Film Classic is available everywhere, and it's highly, highly recommended. Daniel Devesay, thank you so much for being on the show.
It's been my pleasure, sir.